Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the campaign to defeat fast-track legislation in Congress, which would grant President Bush authority to negotiate future trade deals with minimal debate. Soren Ambrose with the 50 Years is Enough Network, who describes demonstrations being organized to greet the World Bank and IMF when these institutions convene their annual meeting in Washington, D.C. this September. And Judy Robbins with the group Let Cuba Live, who talks about the U.S. Customs seizure of medical aid on the Canadian border intended for the people of Cuba. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Years ago, Nigeria, Africa's largest nation, elected a new president, Olusegun Obasanjo, in the hopes of restoring democracy and ending massive government corruption that kept millions of people in deep poverty. In a step to confront past rights abuses, President Obasanjo established the Human Rights Violations Investigations Commission, modeled after the South African Truth Commission, to document past abuses by the military and provide a forum to the victims to tell their stories. In contrast to South Africa, the Nigerian Human Rights Panel is poorly funded and lacks major investigative powers. According to the news magazine In These Times, critics now question the rights panel's credibility. George Nafer, a resident of the oil-rich Ogoniland region in the Niger Delta, claims that the commission is a waste of time and a waste of resources. For the last 30 years, Ogoniland was exploited by international oil companies and provided the tax revenue for Nigeria's corrupt military rulers. Today, the 9 million people who live there are mired in stark poverty, lack electricity, drinkable water, and basic health care. In the early 1990s, playwright and environmentalist Ken Sarawiwa led a militant campaign for justice in Ogoniland. For a time, protests forced the Shell Oil Company to stop its production activities in the Delta. In response, the military cracked down on the activists and looted Ogoni villages and helped Shell to resume pumping out crude oil. In 1995, Sarawiwa and eight others were hung by the government. Today, residents of Ogoniland are skeptical of any government-sponsored human rights investigation. Sarawiwa's father, Chief Jim Beesanwiwa, has denounced the commission by saying it will never compensate villagers for the people killed, houses burned, and crops looted. Scranton, Pennsylvania native Ernie Preet knows both sides of a prison cell. For 11 years, he served as a tough law and order district attorney and won a reputation for winning big cases and putting convicted murderers on death row. By the late 1980s, he became the state attorney general as a Republican and won more converts to his war on crime. But everything changed for Preet in 1995 after he was convicted in federal court of accepting $20,000 in illegal cash donations. While in federal prison, Preet's views on criminal justice were turned upside down in just a week. He became a prison reformer. According to the Progressive magazine, several politicians have become reformers after they serve time behind prison bars. Some influential figures include New York State Judge Sol Wachter and former Clinton aide Webster Hubbell, who now works for the reform-minded National Center for Institutions and Alternatives. Advocates like Julie Stewart of Families Against Mandatory Minimums are now working with ex-inmate politicians to build support for prison reform, especially among conservative Republicans. As Preet recently concluded, this is common sense. We can't keep building prisons, or pretty soon we are going to end up with more people in prison than we have kids in school. The Coca-Cola Company announced in March that they would begin cutting back on their aggressive campaign to flood public schools with their products. However, the world's largest soft drink manufacturer's influence in the schools won't disappear anytime soon. The Coca-Cola Corporation, based in Atlanta, Georgia, has little control over the army of independent bottlers that actually produce the product. Each knows that if one bottler doesn't bid for a school's contract, someone else will. Secondly, the schools themselves have a thirst for the additional revenue they garner from soft drink sales. So addicted have schools become to this added income that in one instance, education officials in Ohio disobeyed a state ban on selling soft drinks during breakfast and lunch. Their quest for profits not only put them at odds with the state, but also with federal law in this case. In Maryland, groups like the National Association of Secondary School Principals got together with the bottlers to oppose a bill that would have limited commercialism in public schools. This legislation, the Captive Audience Stop Commercialism in Schools Act of 2001, was intended to ban advertising in schools, limit sales of candy and soda, and prohibit the placement of corporate logos in textbooks. It went down in flames before the joint onslaught of school officials and soda lobbyists. An average school which enters into a standard contract to sell a quota of soft drinks stands to make $100,000 annually, money to purchase computers, band uniforms, and class trips. But ironically, this works out to about $10 or $15 per student, raising the question, couldn't society find some other way to fund its schools? This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Fraser and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Congress will soon consider legislation that would grant President Bush authority to negotiate future international trade deals, with minimal debate and no chance for legislators to propose corrective amendments. The so-called fast-track bill, now dubbed Trade Promotion Authority by the Bush administration, was defeated by a progressive coalition led by the AFL-CIO when President Clinton tried to win congressional approval in 1997. Then, as now, a broad coalition of groups, including family farmers, environmentalists, and students, joined with labor to oppose Fast Track. If approved, the Fast Track process would be applied to the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, or FTAA. The FTAA would expand many of the provisions of the North America Free Trade Agreement to every nation in the hemisphere except for Cuba. FTAA, like NAFTA, has been criticized for the power it surrenders to corporations, leading to the erosion of democracy and national sovereignty. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Laurie Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the campaign to defeat Fast Track and why her group opposes the expansion of free trade agreements without provisions protecting labor rights and the environment.
Well, Fast Track isn't exactly a negotiating authority. What it does is it delegates away all of Congress's constitutionally granted authority over setting the terms of trade. And what it does, really, is cut Congress and the public out of trade policymaking. It allows the executive branch to set the terms of trade. It allows the executive branch to sign trade agreements binding the U.S. before Congress even votes. And it allows the executive branch to write the legislation, thousands of pages, conforming all U.S. laws to the international agreements, obviously something the legislative branch should do. And then it allows the avoidance of regular congressional procedures. No committee hearings, no amendments allowed on the floor, it's an up or down vote, and only 20 hours of debate. The bill is automatically set up for a vote after a certain number of days after the White House drops it in. And the reason President Bush is so eager for it, and the reason why this is the fight of all time, is because it is granted in multi-year chunks, 5 or 7 years, and it sets parameters for what will be, can be, in future trade agreements. So all of the incredible citizen victories in Seattle, stopping the fast track when President Clinton asked for it, Congress said no after huge grassroots campaigns, all of that has come to a place where really the question is how will we make trade agreements and what will be in them? And we could have floor action in the House of Representatives by August, by the first week of August, and the trick is going to be in the House, that's where the real fight is, and we have to get half to say no. They're not going to give this president, or for that matter any president, a blank check to rewrite our food safety standards, set up corporations to sue the government over costs of regulations, to undermine access in poor countries to pharmaceuticals, all the rotten things that are in today's trade agreements. Those are not acceptable. And the only way we're going to get a change is if we get a different way of making the policy.
Now, the big treaty at stake is the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the FTAA and what's at stake in your view in terms of the fast-track authority and then what comes later in terms of actually the nuts and bolts of FTAA itself.
Well, in a moment of stunning but helpful candor, President Bush announced that the reason he wanted fast-track was so as to expand NAFTA to 31 more countries through the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA. So he's actually fessed up that what he has in mind for Fast Track is to expand NAFTA. FTAA literally takes pieces of NAFTA text and would then apply it to, for instance, Brazil, which still has many domestic policies that direct investment, that guarantee access to certain services, that really hasn't sucked up the entire Washington consensus neoliberal model, as well as to all the Caribbean, small Caribbean countries. And the effect, if you see what NAFTA did to Mexico, could be devastating. And Bush, of course, is very eager to help his corporate friends gain control of the economies of all these countries. And on some level, the Republicans know that the only way they'll ever get a NAFTA expansion is if they put the Congress and the public in handcuffs with something like Fast Track and zoom it through. The FTA contains all of the elements that NAFTA has, plus some additional ones. It has extremely controversial provisions that allow corporations to sue governments, not in our domestic courts, but in secretive NAFTA tribunals, for a private enforcement of new investor rights granted under the trade agreements that, among other things, guarantee that an investor can get reimbursed for regulatory costs. Outrageous.
Has the growing scrutiny about free trade, the NAFTA agreement, and certainly a lot of the protests around the hemisphere on NAFTA, as well as the proposed FTAA treaty, has that at all changed the minds or the strategy or approach of the governments and the large corporations that are pushing this idea?
I would say that the thing that has been the most important and that needs to continue happening is for people across the country in the U.S., to be vocal and get with their members of Congress and hold them accountable. Because here's what we've seen more than anything. There have been several members who've lost their seats because the member of Congress has voted the wrong way on trade. The corporations have paid them up the schnoz to do that, and they still lose. And so what we've seen more than anything that has changed the trend is congressional district by congressional district, when even a handful of dedicated citizen activists get together and start following around their member of Congress, showing up at their town hall meetings, setting up appointments for the office hours, hooking up with their local labor folks and Sierra Club representatives, church leaders, that coalition has actually, if you will, scared a growing number of members of Congress into doing the right thing. The Republican leadership wants to have this happen in the first week of August. It'll be a close vote. Fast Track will be defeated if people get with their members of Congress and basically hold their feet to the fire.
That was Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. During the late 1990s, there has been a rebirth of activism around the globe, with growing scrutiny of international economic institutions. This culminated in the U.S. with militant protest at the World Trade Organization's November 1999 ministerial summit in Seattle. Massive demonstrations were also organized against World Bank and International Monetary Fund policies in Prague last September, and at the institution's April 1999 meetings in Washington, D.C. More protests are being organized to welcome the World Bank and IMF when they return to Washington this September. Groups calling for the overhaul or abolition of these financial institutions complain that their lending policies in the Third World exacerbate the gap between rich and poor, largely benefiting powerful transnational corporations. Critics point out that the billions of dollars lent to developing nations come with strings attached in the form of structural adjustment programs, or SAPs. SAPs mandate debtor governments to open their economies to foreign corporations, focus agriculture on export crops, balance budgets through cuts in social programs, and privatize publicly held enterprises. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Soren Ambrose, policy analyst with the 50 Years is Enough Network, who talks about the growing worldwide opposition to the policies of the World Bank and the IMF, and the protests being planned for Washington, D.C. September 26th through October 4th.
Everything more or less did change with Seattle, and that was, you know, not a coincidence. There was a lot of planning that went into that to bring a lot of different forces together to the kind of crazy quilt in the April 2000 demonstrations in Washington. But now I think we see an opportunity to make that grow even more because, of course, we want to avoid getting into the trap of preaching to the converted and bringing the same people and only the same people to Washington for the demonstrations at the annual meetings of these institutions in the fall. So we're still working to make sure the students are there, the anarchists are there, the folks who are still true to their ideals of the 60s, make sure they're there and make sure more of them are there. But we're also concentrating on a lot of outreach to folks who we believe should be down with the same message, people in labor unions, people in churches, particularly in African-American churches who struggle with a lot of the same economic issues here in the United States, the same kinds of stacked deck in the economic arrangements that people in Africa, Asia, Latin America have been struggling against for so long. So it's not easy all the time, but we are making some progress as we make preparations for the fall, and I think we're going to see probably at least as big a protest as we saw in Seattle, maybe even bigger. And I think we will see the most diverse, most robust demonstrations in the U.S. yet on the issues of globalization. The festivities really begin, I guess, on Wednesday, September 26th, which is the day that there will be a large immigrant rights march here in Washington, and proceed through the following week, through Thursday, October 4th. The IMF and World Bank meetings get underway over the weekend, the 29th and 30th. We expect that the largest direct action, the largest rally and march, all of that sort of thing will be occurring on Sunday, September 30th, which is the day of the meeting of the IMF's main decision-making committee. So that those are the big days, but there will be a teach-in going from the 27th through the 29th. There will be demonstrations about militarization in Latin America, about President Bush's agenda, and all sorts of other things that all have to relate to the economic justice issues that globalization has brought to the fore.
In pinning down somewhat the problems that you and a whole lot of people in this country and around the world have with the policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, maybe you can discuss what you're advocating. Is it abolition of the World Bank and the IMF, or a major reform of what they do and how they do it?
Well, that's always a tricky question, because what we're advocating doesn't have so much to do with what institutions exist and what you call them. It has more to do with the reality on the ground. And what we're working towards is a time when people are able to make economic decisions for their communities, for themselves, without undue interference from outside forces. The status quo we have now is that the major economic policy decisions that have tremendous impact on actually probably more than well over half the world's population are made in Washington, D.C. By bureaucrats at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And we are working to change that system. Now, if that means that we have to abolish those institutions, I would have no hesitation. If a solution were cobbled together where we still had something called the World Bank, but it had been completely democratized, some days I have a hard time imagining how that would look, but I'm open to the possibility that we'll end up with something we call the World Bank that functions to deliver quality assistance in the form of grants, in the form of economic advice that's not tainted by the ideology of neoliberalism. Then I think that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily reject that. The IMF, on the other hand, is a hard institution to imagine recuperating. That will probably have to become extinct.
How much effect have these massive demonstrations had on the policy of the IMF and World Bank? And what can you tell us about the sort of reaction to the whole rising consciousness around the world about what they do?
really, in the end, it's not going to be about persuading these folks of the justice of our call, because their interests are really tied up with the system as it stands. For all the rhetoric the World Bank comes up with, they never make one single change in their structural adjustment agenda. They change a lot of programs. They come up with new names, but they never actually change the policies. I think it's going to be a matter of building the power in the communities and taking the power through political processes and really forcing the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO to change the way they do business, or to actually go out of existence, and we'll start over with new ways of ordering the international economic order.
That was Soren Ambrose, policy analyst with the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network by calling area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. On July 2nd, the 12th U.S.-Cuba Friendship Caravan, organized by Pastors for Peace, crossed the U.S. border from Hidalgo, Texas, into Reynosa, Mexico, without interference from U.S. officials. The 95 participants were transporting more than 75 tons of humanitarian aid to be donated without license to Cuba as a challenge to the 40-year-old U.S. economic blockade of that island nation. However, on that same day, at Coburn Gore border crossing in the Maine woods, a related group was stopped, attempting to cross the U.S. border into Quebec, Canada, with four truckloads of medical aid. 40 participants were part of the caravan organized by the Maine-based group Let Cuba Live, along with the Quebec-Cuba Friendship Association and Pastors for Peace. A border standoff ensued when U.S. officials refused to allow two of the trucks loaded with critically needed anesthesiology equipment and medical aid for Cuba to cross the border. Two of the participants carried aid over the border and were threatened with arrest. Judy Robbins is with the Maine-based group Let Cuba Live. She spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about the seizure and how her group is still determined to deliver the medical aid to Cuba.
We are a grassroots Maine organization that has been working since 1992 to end the U.S. embargo of Cuba. We work frequently in partnership with Pastors for Peace, the New York organization, and this year we have planned a regional caravan of medical aid that we had intended to take to Montreal for delivery to Cuba, and we planned it to coincide with the Pastors for Peace caravan that was going to cross from Texas into Mexico, and both of these caravans took place on Monday, July 2nd.
The one in Texas that crossed the border in Hidalgo actually went without incident, is that correct?
That's right. Not only without incident, but with a police escort. They had no inspections, no questions asked. They were effectively waved across the border and were able to continue on their way to Cuba.
Well, if I understand correctly, not only have the 11 previous caravans gone without license regarding the aid, but this one as well. So Texas went without incident, and the Coburn-Gore Maine incident actually did end up in a standoff.
That's right. It actually ended up in a standoff that lasted for several hours. We had some of our aid in Canada. Some of our aid was locked up in the customs garage there at the border. We had one lonely little box of hospital supplies out on the street with two young men who were participating with us sitting on the box and refusing to give it up. They started calling in the state police and the local county sheriff's department, border patrol, and eventually they had between 20 and 25 armed officers lined up in the street threatening to arrest these two young men who were clinging to this one box of hospital supplies. And that standoff lasted over 2 hours. Eventually, the young men chose to get up off the box, and Customs seized that box as well.
We here at WPK and Judy Robbins have been covering all of these caravans since just about the first one, and know full well the inconsistency regarding U.S.-Cuba policy, actually since 1996, I would have to say, since 400 computers were seized on San Ysidro border and were confiscated and held for almost 8 months, which created an international incident, if you will. Since then, it seems that most of the caravans have been not only without incident, but as you stated, with police escort. And I think that may be almost intentional, or at least it appears on the surface, to keep it out of the news. However, this particular one is getting a lot of coverage, I believe, in Quebec and up in Maine. What do you attribute the inconsistency to here?
We really don't know quite what to make of it. We, because of the past five or so caravans being waved through by Treasury Department, we had reason to expect that that was going to happen again. We were actually prepared for a little outing with our friends in Montreal. I think it's possible that there was a miscommunication. I think it's also possible that they have chosen to sort of pick on us because we're a small, isolated group without the national recognition that Pastors for Peace has. And we're working very hard to raise the level of awareness of what's going on because of that double standard, because they waved pastors through in Texas and came down very hard on us and told us that they were going to take every piece of aid that we had. And fortunately, we managed to get a little bit of it into Canada. Actually, the last time we came through the Cobourne-Gore border was a Pastors for Peace, Let Cuba Live caravan coming from Canada into Maine, so it was the other direction, but they're very aware of our relationship with the Pastors for Peace.
What is happening right now?
As of this morning, our lawyer just received in the mail the official notice of seizure, which has outlined the steps that the Treasury Department believes we can choose from, what our legal options are. And we have called for a day of action on July 21st, where we'll be holding a rally in the center of Portland, Maine, which is one of our larger population areas. And then we're going to have a march on the Customs House on the afternoon of July 21st.
So basically all of the people were allowed through it?
Yeah, there were no arrests. There was no detention of people. Also, I wanted to mention that the Pastors for Peace will be returning to the United States, I believe, on the 12th, and they will be attempting a reverse challenge. They're going to bring a gift from the people of Cuba to the people of the United States.
What will they be returning with?
Well, I'm not sure of everything they're bringing, but one thing that they are bringing is a product called BioRat. It's produced only in Cuba, and it's an environmental rodent control. It's used to keep down rodent populations to protect food safety. And it's been used successfully in countries around the world. Uganda, I'm not sure what other countries are using it, but it's a product that Cuba sells on the open market and would be of tremendous interest, I'm sure, to a lot of communities in the United States.
That was Judy Robbins of Let Cuba Live. For more information, call area code 207-326-4405 or visit the group's website at www.letcubalive.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.